Hey, good morning. Welcome to the October 11th, 2019 edition of The Other Animals. I am your host, Laurent Levy. I'm happy to be with you as fall settles in over the Delaware Valley and the greater Northeast. If you're new to The Other Animals, what we try to do here is just figure out what our role is or can be as human animals when it comes to those other non-human animals. So with apologies to Bubba Blue, then for you young'uns, that's a Forrest Gump reference. Here we go. We can experiment on them. We can eat them. We can ride them. We can love them. We can admire them. We can crush them. We can shoot them. We can poison them. We can copy them. We can make them our mascots. We can pet them. We can walk them. We can weaponize them. We can clone them. We can eat their hormonal secretions, as in eggs and milk. We can send them to space. We can send them into coal mines. We can cull them. We can draw and paint them. We can write about them. We can make them entertain us. We can feed them. We can use them to make medicine for us. We can domesticate them. We can trap them. We can sacrifice them. We can use their skins, their antlers, their horns, their feet, their teeth, for clothing, fashion, jewelry, trinkets, aphrodisiacs, trophies, or musical instruments. We can protect them. We can torment them. We can worship them. We can curse them. We can try and communicate with them. We can dissect them. We can spay and neuter them. We can inseminate them. We can breed them to our liking. We can cause their extinction. We can make them our protectors and sentries. We can make them our couriers. We can bait them, or we can use them as bait. We can race them. We can stuff them. We can rope them. We can wrestle them. We can heal them. We can capture them. We can exhibit them. We can liberate them. That's about it. Except it isn't. I left out one or two of the absolute best things we can do. We can observe them, and we can listen to them. In fact, there is an entire organization of people out there devoted to that enterprise, and they call themselves birders. Armed only with a good pair of binoculars, warm clothing, and perhaps some expensive photographic equipment, they take a singular delight in witnessing the panoply of our flying brethren in their natural surroundings without trying to alter them or their world in any way. And since I like to quote old movies, they, like Chauncey Gardner, just like to watch. But will they be able to see the variety they once could? Birding and ornithology are topics on The Other Animals. But first, it's time for Animals in the News. All right, we have to start with a sad one. I'm pretty sure you probably heard about this one because this one rose in the big news. And you may have seen the videos of this is the six elephants that drowned after plunging into the waterfall. Let me just read it and comment about it. So six elephants died while trying to save each other after a baby elephant fell from a waterfall in a Thai national park, officials said. And this really sort of follows up on our topic last week, in fact. So staff at Khao Yai National Park, about 85 miles north of Bangkok, found the roughly three-year-old baby elephant drowned on Saturday. And there were five more dead elephants also discovered at the bottom of this, probably not pronouncing right, Hao Narok Waterfall, according to the Thailand Department of National Parks. Officials found two live elephants on the waterfall's cliff attempting to go down to help the other elephants, and a veterinarian is still caring for them. The two elephants right now are taking a rest. They are exhausted from trying to cross the stream, a veterinarian told the AP. Elephants are sympathetic animals that have been known to help each other when they are distressed. They also show something resembling grief when one of their own dies. The discovery on Saturday was prompted by a report of several elephants on a nearby road, Thai officials said. The waterfall was closed to visitors after the dead elephants were discovered. It was also the site of a similar incident in 1992 when eight elephants fell to their deaths there, the BBC reported. That park is Thailand's third largest national park, and the park's tallest waterfall has three tiers that total about 492 feet. Elephants are common nearby. This story, the only comment on this is there are still some people out there who sort of question not just elephants, but other animals' ability to have these type of responses that the article talks about, to grieve, to try to protect each other, to really risk their life, which is what these other elephants did. They risked their life unsuccessfully to save the baby. I don't know. Is there any doubt? Is there any doubt that they are expressing a kind of higher consciousness to be able to make that kind of sacrifice. I can't imagine that. All right. Anyway, next comes. This is an interesting source. This is from. I don't usually do these, but this is from a scholarly journal. I try not to get too much into the weeds here, but this is PLOS One, which is a journal of various scholastic publications, and it has to do with a study that was done. What if cows could avoid flies from biting them just by wearing stripes? So according to this article that was published, Japanese researchers painted zebra-style stripes on cows, and biting flies bothered them half as much as the cows without the stripes. The idea is that stripes may indeed confuse insect motion detection systems that control whether flies approach or land on the striped animal. For the study, researchers painted 6 Japanese black cows with black and white stripes. So you always kind of wonder, was it the white stripe on the black cow or the black stripe on the white cow? Then observed the cows with and without the painted stripes for 3 days. Researchers snapped high-resolution photos of the cattle at various times to count the number of insects pestering the cows. They also observed the cows to see if they stamped their legs, moved their tails, and other usual physical behaviors to repel the flies. Researchers continued to watch the striped cows to see if the paint chemicals actually repelled the flies. According to the results from the study, the number of biting flies seen on the striped cows was less than half the number seen on unpainted cows. We found that painting zebra-like stripes on cows can decrease the incidence of biting flies landing on individuals by 50%, according to the study's findings. We also found that the reduced landings of biting flies coincide with a reduction in defensive behaviors in cows. Currently, and our word from last week, the livestock industry uses pesticides on cattle to fight off biting flies, but this research could prove there's a less toxic and possibly cheaper alternative to using chemicals. Why else would we want to keep the flies off of the cows other than, you know, so that we can in turn eat them? This work provides an alternative to the use of conventional pesticides for mitigating biting fly attacks on livestock that improves animal welfare and human health, in addition to helping resolve the problem of pesticide resistance in the environment, the study stated. Okay, so speaking of sources, the next story comes from a source I normally don't go to, but I just couldn't resist. So this one comes from Fox News. Mm-hmm. All right. And somehow the headline fits what you might expect a headline to be from Fox News. And the headline reads, "Snakehead fish discovered in Georgia sparks warning from wildlife officials. Kill it immediately." All right, and here's what it says. An invasive fish species has been spotted in Georgia, and wildlife officials want anyone who encounters it to, quote, immediately kill the animal, which can survive on both land and in water. The northern snakehead, native to the Yangtze River Basin located in China, was discovered in a Gwinnett County pond earlier this month, according to the state's Department of Natural Resources, which noted the creatures have been reported in 14 U.S. states. It's unclear how the fish ended up in the pond, but a blog post from the department explains invasive species, quote, are often introduced throughout unauthorized release, unquote. The fish, which are long and thin with a dark appearance and a long dorsal fin that runs along its back, can grow up to 3 feet long. They are able to breathe air, allowing them to survive on land and in low oxygenated systems. Okay, that is kind of creepy. But because northern snakeheads can negatively impact native species by competing for the same resources, wildlife officials encourage anyone who comes across the fish to kill it immediately and freeze it. The department urges people to photograph the fish, including some close-up shots of its mouth, fins, and tail. Remember where and when you found it, and immediately report it to the office's Wildlife Resources Division Fisheries Office. Hunter Roop, an official with the DNR, told WSB-TV they have boots on the ground. Oh, yeah. As they search for the fish and are, quote, trying to understand the magnitude of the problem. What is the magnitude of the problem? Here we go. They have the potential to prey directly on bass, especially younger bass. So, well, we would say ask any anglers that do catch a snakehead to kill it immediately, then call the DNR so we can document when and where. So that's the real thing, right? These guys come along and now suddenly the fishermen don't have anything to fish. All right. Our last story also comes from Fox. Madrid to cull nearly 12,000 invasive parakeets over threats to the environment and public safety. And this is Madrid as in Spain. Madrid City Council on Monday announced plans to rid the Spanish capital of thousands of invasive parakeets through, quote, ethical culling. Culling, there's one of those words that we talked about. We love the language, culling. And sterilization of eggs. Monk parakeets, native to Argentina, commonly were imported from South America as pets before Spain outlawed the bright green birds in 2011. That's interesting. Now considered an invasive species, a recent study by the Spanish Society of Ornithology showed the population has exploded over the last 3 years from 9,000 to nearly 12,000. In 2005, there were only 1,700 of those birds in Madrid. It wasn't made clear what specific means officials would use to target the parakeets. While the birds have made loud, unpleasant screeching noises throughout the city, Santiago Osorio Carreras, the head of the biodiversity service at Madrid City Hall, told El Pay they pose real safety risks to the public and environment. Monk parakeets have competed with the city's native species for food and destroyed vegetation to make their stick nests. The nests, which can weigh up to 440 pounds, could be deadly if they fall out of a tree and land on people. What a way to go. The birds also could transmit diseases to humans, such as, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this, maybe Tom could help, psittacosis, parrot fever, avian flu, and salmonella, The Guardian reported. The plan is expected to start next year with a cost ranging between $6 and $9 for each parakeet, a sum that could add up to $110,000. All right, well, that actually, with the birds, that actually gives us an interesting segue. So when we return, we will be talking with Bruce Quinlan from the Delaware Valley Ornithological Club about parakeets and other birds and birding. And later on, we'll be talking with Jordan Rutter from the American Bird Conservancy. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have all pets house calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard. Come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
All right, welcome back to The Other Animals on WWDB. We're joining now by Brian Quinlan, Brian B.Q. Quinlan. He's an elementary school teacher and avid birder from Philadelphia. He's a member of the Delaware Valley Ornithological Club, and he runs the youth birding program, Trailblazers, and also documents his birding escapades through his Instagram, Birding with B.Q. Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you for having me. Good morning.
Yeah, I definitely appreciate it coming on short notice. I know it was a little bit of a scramble there, so just want to thank you for that. So tell me how you got into it. How'd you get into birding? How did it start?
Well, you know, I started birding as a young kid. In fact, my mentor that got me into birding was an instructor at a local YMCA in Berwyn, Pennsylvania, the Upper Mainline YMCA. Cool. And when I was a kid, I actually signed up for a bluebird box building class as a child. And I went to the class, and it turns out I was the only kid signed up for it. So the instructor and I built all these bluebird boxes together, and basically at the end of it, I was so drawn to this guy's personality and his love of the environment that I had to go back to whatever his next session was. And as he continued to have these nature sessions, it ended up kind of building a nature club for kids that I was a part of and ended up making a lot of friends in. And basically, birding became part of my life at a very young age for me, about 10 years old, I would guess, all told. And then from there, I've never really looked back.
That's really cool. So what is a bluebird box, for those who may know?
Oh.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, great question. So the eastern bluebird, one of our local nesting bird species, actually is a cavity nester, meaning that it nests in holes in things, whether it's a hole in a tree and like a hole in a log. People will actually build bird boxes to put up out on their lawns to attract bluebirds because people oftentimes when they have a dead tree will tear it down. They'll replicate that habitat by building a bluebird box. So that was kind of my first introduction to birding was building a bluebird box and learning about the eastern bluebird and the fact that it's important to build habitat for a species where habitat's declining.
All right. So what kind of So there's not just those type of boxes. They're not just for bluebirds, right? You can build those type of boxes for any type of birds?
There's a couple of different kind of bird boxes out there. It really depends upon size of the box and the size of the cavity that you're building on it, but also it depends upon where you put it. So like you could take a bluebird box, and if you put it in the forest, you'll probably get other birds that would use it, not bluebirds, because typically a bluebird box wants to be should be placed out on a lawn with short grass, with not a lot of obstructions nearby. That's how you attract a bluebird to it. But you could put the same box in a different habitat, and it would be beneficial to a different species in some cases.
Okay. All right. So let's step back a little bit. So so building the boxes is one thing. For people who have never done it before, tell us about, like, if you could give us a birding 101. All right, I've never done it. I've never been out on an expedition. But what would be what is it? What do you go out and you look at? But you take pictures of them. Is it do you have to be at a distance? Is it different season? Are you looking at migration? What are you actually doing? What is it?
Wow, that's a great question.
Yeah, it's wide. I know. So go for it.
So when it comes to getting into birding, binoculars seem to be something that everybody has, whether people have it for birding or people have a pair of binoculars that maybe their grandfather bought to sit in the nosebleeds at the Spectrum to watch the Flyers game. Everyone seems to have a pair of binoculars. So that's really the first thing you want to get is a pair of binoculars. Once you do that, you want to get out to a place that is going to be a great habitat to go looking for birds. You could go into your backyard if you want, especially if you have bushes and trees and you have some green space. But I recommend trying to get to a local nature preserve if you're going to go birding for the first time. And then it's going to require patience from there. Mm-hmm. Because at the end of the day, when you're out birding in these habitats, the problem with these birds is they don't like to be near people. So you have to use the binoculars and be quiet. You have to keep a relative distance from the birds as to not disturb them. But you want to be close enough that you can look at them with the binoculars, see them clearly, and then take the time to study and learn about what the birds are by looking at their colors, mm-hmm. looking at their shape, even listening to their sounds if mm-hmm. you like to listen to things.
So it's as I was saying in the intro, it is, you do this at a distance, you don't really disturb them, and you're at their mercy. You have to be patient, and you have to wait for them. So when you see them, there's a thrill in just seeing them, right? And just in seeing the color, being able to identify the breed. What do you do then? Do you try to take pictures? Do you log it? It seems like it would only be for a few fleeting seconds or a few moments that you actually get to see them, right?
Sometimes. So I'm a photographer now, but I would say for the first almost 20 years of my birding life, I did not own a camera for birding at all. So you don't have to own a camera to be a birder. However, owning a camera does help, because if you're out in the field and you see a bird that you're not familiar with, you can always photograph it and then look at your photograph later mm-hmm. to try to identify it. I'll admit that even I, after 20 years of birding, finally getting a camera, when I started photographing birds, I learned so much more about them because I was able to go back and study them with the photographs I've taken.
It's interesting. Like, I would think if I was new to birding, that's almost a conundrum, because tell me if I'm wrong, but when you encounter a bird, there's to me it would seem like there's a thrill of being in the moment. You're finally this particular bird has landed. It's come into your field of vision, and you have this brief moment, this brief opportunity to actually just see it and behold it, and just appreciate this moment. And you have to, if you bring the camera out, you introduce a distraction for yourself. And maybe, you know, it preserves the moment for a later time, but it potentially disrupts your ability to appreciate that moment where you're one-on-one virtually, maybe, you know, with the bird. Is that a problem? Is that something that as you get more experienced that you learn to deal with it?
You know, I have to say it's a little bit of both. I feel like there are times where if I'm going to go birding to relax, you know, I always bring my camera with me, but a lot of times I won't use it. If I'm just trying to be out in nature and enjoy a beautiful day and just enjoy a walk, I won't necessarily be out there to photograph. However, if I'm out and I see something I don't know, it's good to have my camera with me to photograph it just in case, or if I run into something less common or even rare, it's really great to have your camera for that. But you do run into that problem where I find myself like kind of trapped between I want to be out and enjoy a beautiful day and kind of, you know, have a nice quiet time out in nature. But then at the same time, if I see a beautiful opportunity to capture a bird, I do kind of have to take myself out of the moment to have my camera set, ready to go, get on the bird, make sure my focus is ready. So it is a little bit challenging, and it does kind of take you out of the moment at times. But for me as an elementary school teacher, to photograph birds and take videos of birds, it's great because I can then take the exact photo of this exact bird that I saw, and I can share it with others and kind of tell the story of that bird and get people connected with it, because there are so many incredible and unbelievable birds in our area, right in our own backyards, and folks don't even know that it's there. So I feel like photography is a really great way to be able to tell the story of the birds that you get to see.
That's great. Now, you mentioned, you mentioned your... that you're a teacher, and I know you. As I mentioned in your introduction, you you run a program called Trailblazers that is particularly geared to youth and getting them into birding. To tell us about that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So this is the start of our eighth year of the program here in Garnet Valley School District, and the Trailblazers program is an after-school club during the school year. We actually have two chapters: one here at our Bethel Springs Elementary School, where I teach fourth grade, and another at Garnet Valley Elementary School that we started kind of recently. And then we also have a summer camp format as well for the students, where we spend a lot of time here at our school because we have a nature trail on the campus that we can go birding with.
Oh, nice.
But in the summertime with camp, we actually rent our school buses and we go out on the road to great local birding hotspots to basically take the skills that we've developed here on campus and on our own nature trail and take them to new habitats to learn the importance of quality habitat and practice of experiencing new birds.
Mm-hmm. What's the most memorable experience you've had, either with yourself or with the kids? I imagine, I would imagine, I'm going to guess here, that there's something with the first time a kid gets one, you know, sees one, seeing their face light up, that must be incredibly rewarding. I don't know. Have you had one like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, for me, you know, having grown up as a kid birding, and my mentor, Brian Rasich, that got me into it, I feel like a lot of what I do with the Trailblazers program was completely inspired by him, because if not for his, you know, his part of being in my life and exposing me to birding and nature, I don't know who I'd be today and where I'd be today. So to be able to kind of carry the torch that he gave me with that is truly an honor in that regard. And as much as I do love to go birding on my own, and I love to go look for especially rare and unusual birds here in like in Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Delaware, seeing the students enjoying birds for the first time and seeing them get super excited, I love that. And then to see them stick with it and having multiple years pass where students are coming back and we're talking about sightings and they're taking their love of nature, whether they're getting into birding or getting into other environmental facets, that's, for me, that's better than any rare bird or anything unexpected like that. I will say though that I will say that one of the most recent moments I had this past Tuesday at our bird club, we walked outside in front of our school, and some of the students were a little cold, so some went back inside to get their jackets. And while I was waiting for them to go back get their jackets, a bald eagle flew right over the parking lot.
Wow. Oh my God! And they were able to. It was definitely an eagle, and they saw it.
Oh yeah!
Oh,
everyone
wow.
got to see it, and I had my camera with me because again, I always bring my camera because you never know when something unexpected is going to show up. The time you don't bring your camera is like when the rarest thing shows
up. Of course,
so,
right?
Yeah. So I broke out my camera. I got photos of it, and I was able to email it to the families to show them, "Hey, look at this amazing bird we got to see right out front of our school." So my hope is that it's a lesson for the students and a lesson for the families that, hey, we have amazing wildlife. Sometimes passes right over our heads. And, you know, had we not looked up, we would have missed it. So hopefully folks are keeping an eye out for birds and looking around for, you know, looking around in nature for the beautiful things we have.
All right. I know you have to run. I have one last question for you. So tell us about this organization right here in our backyard, the Delaware Valley Ornithological Club. I know it's an old one. Tell us about it, and what if people want to get involved with it? Tell us about that.
So the DVOC, as we call it, because ornithological is definitely a mouthful to those who aren't familiar.
Yeah, I've been struggling with it all morning here.
Yeah, DVOC was founded in 1890. It's ranked as one of the oldest bird clubs in the nation. It meets twice a month at the Academy of Natural Sciences right here in Philadelphia. And basically, meetings are open to anyone who is interested. After a while, those that maybe start to become visitors eventually you know, can join the club. But if you just want to visit and see what it's all about, we'd love to have folks come by because typically a meeting consists of talking about recent sightings, upcoming field trips, and then we usually have a featured speaker, a program from either a club member or an expert in the birding field to come in and talk about a variety of topics. Could be about a trip. It could be about a species. Very wide range, but it's a really cool club because people in this club are from all walks of life, some of whom have a very professional ornithological backgrounds, some of whom are into birds just as a hobby. But it's a great cross-section of people. It's a really energized club that's very active because not only do we have the meetings, but we also have field trips on weekends. And spun off of that, we also have an initiative called Bird Philly, where we have basically the idea is it's supposed to be engaging people from within the Philly city limits to some of Philadelphia's green spaces. Because one of the things about Philadelphia birding is that there's not a lot of great habitat, but because we have some pockets of great habitat, birds end up there in numbers quite often, places like John Hines National Wildlife Refuge, FDR Park, Penny Pack on the Delaware, the Wissahickon. So to have Bird Philly under the DVOC umbrella, it basically, the whole purpose of these clubs is just get connected with each other and connect people with nature to get people birding and discovering, again, the beauty of all that's right here in our own backyard.
And where, what's the website? Where do people go to find out more?
That's dvoc.org and birdphilly.org.
dvoc.org and birdphilly.org. All right. Well, thanks, Brian. I know you're running a little over for you. I appreciate your time at last minute, and I wish you the best. I thank you again.
Hey, thank you very much, and I hope the listeners out there can grab a pair of binoculars and get out and enjoy some fall migration this weekend.
I do too. All right, thanks a lot. All right, when we
you're welcome.
Take care now. When we come back, we'll be talking with Jordan Rutter. She's from the American Bird Conservancy American Bird Conservancy. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
All right, welcome back to The Other Animals, WDB, and with the cuckoo from Mahler's First Symphony for those who need that. Jordan Rutter, she's a lifelong birder with a passion for connecting others to the natural world through birds. She has a master's degree in conservation biology from the University of Minnesota and over 10 years' experience in the ornithology field. I got it that time. And she's now the American Bird Conservancy's public relations director. Hi, Jordan. Welcome to this program.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
All right. Well, I'll ask you the same question I asked as Brian. How did you get started in birding?
I have a pretty unique story where basically a flooded basement led to my dad needing to get a second part-time job to help to pay for the damages, basically. And so he went to the Wild Bird Center and got a job, and part of his responsibilities was to lead bird walks. And so basically our family jumped in head first, and I got taken along, and it all just went from there. So I have been a lifelong birder, as you said, and just went to school and always tried to learn more. And so here we are today, where I still have this really intense passion to help birds and share birds and talk about birds. So thank you again for having me on the show.
Oh, no, that's wonderful. What's your what's been your best experience birding wise? I'm trying to get this right. What's one that really stands out? Or can you even do that?
Oh, with so many years, it's really hard to pick because there's over 10,000 species of birds in the world. So the hardest question for me is always, what's your favorite bird or what's your favorite moment? Because every time is just so different. There's wonderful birds that you can see. I'm in Washington, D.C., but have family in Pennsylvania. So there's wonderful migratory birds that I always get excited to see every spring, like warblers and flycatchers. But I actually was fortunate enough to travel to South Africa a couple years ago, and the birds there are just so different from here in the U.S. So that was always, or that will always be a really wonderful memory for me.
You know, it's interesting. When you, for those on the outside, and I, as I was saying, I've never done it, but I'm interested in it. It seems like the naming of the birds is such, that's really important. Is that almost like half the fun? And some of these names are really exotic. And just to be able to identify, not just to identify them, but to give them names and to be able to attach the names to what you're seeing. Is that half the battle or half the fun of it?
I think so. It's kind of like a puzzle, right? Mm-hmm. So when you see a bird that you don't identify right away, whether that's as a new birder, like you've never looked at birds before, or even someone that's even more experienced than me, you know, you sometimes you get challenges or you see a bird that just doesn't look quite like what you think. So like I said, it's a puzzle, and naming it is really powerful because that's knowledge. That's halfway to getting to learn more or even having more questions come about, because as soon as you can name it, you can Google it. You can learn more about its behavior and its natural history, learn more that maybe then sparks you to ask other questions or compare it to other birds. So names can be really challenging, though, too, and overwhelming. As I said, there's so many different species. So I highly encourage people to, especially new folks to birding, to start just by families, right? Don't try to whittle it down to just one species. Just focus on, is it a duck or is it, a sparrow? And that is more than okay when you're learning, and it helps you break it down. And that then will help you also kind of funnel it to identify the exact species.
And one of the things that, as you've been talking and Brian before, that it is really you do this from a distance for the most part, right? You're doing this. The birds don't even know you're there for the most part. In fact, if they know you're there, you've messed up somehow because you've maybe startled them and you've hurt your own cause. I'm curious. So there's that. There's bird watching, which is what we've been talking about. But the field of ornithology itself, that has another angle to it, right? In other words, we can't get everything from just pure observation. So ornithology, tell me if I'm wrong, the field is large enough that it doesn't imply capturing, looking up close, grabbing them, tagging them, doing something that is occasionally, I won't say harmful, but impactful. Am I right?
So ornithology, both just from history, I mean, you know, it's 2019 and we have records from hundreds of years ago that people were studying birds. So there are all different angles, and it all does come back to that observation ultimately, though, right? Whether you're observing birds out in the field or observing them in a laboratory or you're observing other data that you're collecting. So a lot of really valuable science and knowledge that we have about birds has come from just watching them. But we also have new age technology that we're using, like radar. And so you can actually see birds during spring and fall migration. There's so much mass, there's so many of them, that they show up on weather radar, which is actually really cool when you think about it. So that's another way. And then there are other studies that are being done where we do catch them, and sometimes you might collect different samples, different measurements. You might measure their wing to see how big they are. Mm-hmm. And all of them are always conducted with the bird's best interest and safety in mind. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's never meant to harm or stress them out, and they're, you know, we're trained professionals.
Okay. All right. So you're with the, speaking of ornithology, you're with the American Bird Conservancy. Tell us about that organization. Is that a government-funded, or is that a private organization, or just What is that?
Yeah, so American Bird Conservancy, known as ABC, is a nonprofit organization that is intended to conserve native birds and their habitats throughout the Americas, the Western Hemisphere. So we focus on native birds from the North Pole to the South Pole, so all the way from Canada to the, you know, southern tips of Argentina and Chile. And what we are trying to do is really make sure that everyone knows and feels empowered, especially today, that they can do things to help birds. And what we are trying to do is basically put that ornithology science into action on the ground and then make sure that these birds are conserved and protected so that we can keep appreciating them and bird watching can thrive.
Okay. All right. Well, that actually brings us to the sort of the heart of actually the whole show. And that science, has led to the publication that everyone's been talking about. And I know the American Bird Conservancy was a partner in this publication. And just for our listeners, just to remind them, I actually put this on the news a couple weeks ago, and this is the article that talks about North America losing 3 billion birds. There were several authors involved in that. It's a sort of a long-term study. And it, you know, on first blush, it looks really sad and disturbing. So first of all, if you could summarize that article, that finding, what's going on with the loss of 3 billion birds, and we'll drill into that a little bit.
Yeah. So this is mostly based off of citizen science data, so data that the public has contributed. So through things like the Christmas bird count or a breeding bird survey, we also use that radar data I spoke about, all of this data that wouldn't have been possible just from one scientist or one research project simply because of the scale of the U.S. and Canada, went into an analysis for the past 50 years, since 1970, and we found that the net population of breeding birds, so we're talking about adult birds in the spring that are going to have chicks, that population has declined by 3 billion individual birds in 50 years.
Birds. Okay. So how can you get from the – oh, because that's a staggering number, right? 3 billion individual.
It is.
Do you – the article, you know, a headline like that says, oh, my God, are we talking about breeds and extinctions? Are these
right.
just so I don't know if you could clarify that.
So we aren't talking about extinctions. Think of it like a human census, right?
Okay.
So just like how there are regular times when censuses are done, we, with this paper, basically we're trying to figure out what is the population and what is the change in population of those adult breeding birds. And I just am focusing on that because obviously the population completely, like, surges after all of those chicks are born, right? It can all of a sudden have this huge spike. But then just because of various threats and just natural survival, that population will decline in the fall. And so we're just trying to really emphasize on that net population. So we're not focusing on extinction. We're just talking about the population change in the past 50 years.
So what's the impact? When you lose that vast a number, what is the ecological or environmental impact?
Yeah, well, so one of the things is that we are then concerned because if the declines continue, then you do get wary of more threatened species or endangered species. So we're not talking about that right off the bat, but that is a concern just because, if the declines continue. And we're also noticing two things. One is birds play an incredibly significant impact in the environment, whether you're talking about hummingbirds that are pollinators or vultures that are nature's cleanup crew since they eat dead things. Birds that eat insects are really important for pest control. So they have a lot of different roles in the environment. But we're also using this as a rallying call. This decline is a time for humans to realize that something is wrong with our environment and we need to act. Because if the birds aren't doing well, then it means that the world isn't doing well. Something is wrong that we can't sustain the historic population of birds.
It's almost the proverbial, pardon me, it's the canary in the coal mine.
exactly.
Right. It, something is up. Something's on the horizon, and this is a warning. So, all right, so let's get to it. So what are some of the things that people can do to...
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of things that people can do. And what I would really love to stress is that there's an entire spectrum, and people should feel empowered to really find what works best for them and meets them with their own abilities or their own lifestyles. So there are things that a 5-year-old can do or an 85-year-old can do. There are things that cost money. There are things that don't cost money. So I highly encourage people to learn more on the ABC website just for more information, which is abcbirds.org. But some of the things you could do today include being a responsible pet owner. So our cats and dogs outside have a huge impact on wildlife. So really making sure that you keep those pets on leashes or are, you know, very observant about where they are to minimize those impacts on wildlife is important, especially cats. We really want to make sure that these pets are just not having an impact on birds. Other things could be making your windows safe. So I'm sure a lot of folks have had the experience of a bird, you know, hitting a window and having that thud. Mm-hmm. And there are things that you can do, whether it's getting certain window paint and making an art project out of it and being very seasonal, or you can actually pay for different retrofits for your window. It's all about...
I'm just curious, how, because I have had that, and when that happens, you think, oh my God, that's such a rare, you know, this bird's nuts or something. But are there numbers? Is that really common, birds flying into windows? Is that like,
yes, it's very common. And in the U.S. alone, up to 1 billion birds collide with windows every year.
Oh.
So, and I want to stress that's different. That billion is different from the paper.
Okay.
So throughout the year, up to 1 billion birds collide with windows.
Is that normally a fatal encounter, or does the bird sometimes just get stunned?
It is. Not to get too sciencey, but just the physics of it, right? So birds have hollow bones, and just the way that they fly into the window, usually, some people might have seen a bird and thought it was okay, or it might have flown off, but the impact gives them such a concussion almost that it's not a good thing. And there aren't bird doctors usually around to help. So think of if you hit a wall, right? You might get a headache or something, but you're large enough and have access to doctors to help.
Right. So for them, they don't. All right. So I didn't mean to derail you there. So we have the cat program, keeping your windows.
Yep.
What else?
Yep. So another thing that we need to be aware of is making sure that birds have safe places to live at any time of year. And so that means habitat, right? Mm-hmm. So in your own backyard, things you can do are using native plants instead of ornamental plants. Ornamental plants are of course beautiful and great for landscaping, but ornamental plants aren't going to support the bugs and insects that birds eat. Mm-hmm. And so basically we want to make sure that our backyards have everything. They have really good restaurants, essentially, with those insects, as well as protection and cover from predators. So using native plants is great. And then avoiding pesticides is another thing that you can do, right? Because ultimately it makes sense that if the organic is a huge increasing trend today, right? Mm-hmm. So if we want to eat organic, then we should realize that other living things would want to have organic.
I mean, it seemed like
non-chemical.
There would be two impacts to the pesticides. One, of course, it's the birds naturally eat the bugs. So if the pesticides are killing them, there's nothing for them to eat. But if they do eat the poisoned or the bugs that have been killed with the pesticide, they're ingesting those chemicals, right? And then that.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep.
All right. Was there anything else? I wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit more. I know you have a there's a back to that first one you were talking about with the cats.
Yeah.
I know that the ABC has a program for that. I was wondering if you could spend a minute or two talking about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so again, on our website, abcbirds.org, please feel free to check that out for resources, scientific literature, different options if you're concerned either about this topic or interested in what you can do. But basically, ABC is saying it's time for us to take responsibility as pet owners and reduce the impact of our cats outdoors.
Okay.
So cats do kill approximately 2.4 billion birds every year in the U.S. alone.
Wow.
And again, that is every year.
That's separate from the study.
Yep, that's
okay.
Separate. Yep.
Oh, okay.
And so we just want to make sure that there's compromises that we can do,
mm-hmm.
right? So
mm-hmm.
we at ABC are not anti-cat. Many of our staff members have cats.
I was going to say,
so there's a quick conversation.
A cat person here. Yeah, go ahead.
Yep. No. We love our cats here at ABC, but that doesn't mean that we can't be responsible for them.
Mm-hmm.
So when we go outside, let's do things that help the cats stay safe and reduce impact on birds, because free roaming cats have a lot of threats that they can encounter as well. They could get hit by a car. They could find poisons or antifreeze and get sick,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And we don't want that. So there are things like leashes or strollers. There are other options like catios, which are basically enclosed outdoor patios just for cats.
Catios. I need one in my life. Okay.
Yeah. There are lots of options. And it's cats don't need, we are not saying they need to suffer and just be stuck inside. There are other options. But it's, again, just being aware of our impact and doing something conscious about it. And again, there's tons of different resources on the ABC website. And it's about working together to help make a positive change.
Okay, so once again, what's the website? Just abcbirds.org?
Correct. Okay. Or we're on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. So.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, I'm going to try a little something different here. So I have to take a break. When we come back, we're joined by our resident veterinarian, Dr. Tom Picard of All Pets House Calls. And Jordan, I'm hoping you can stay with us for a second, because I think Tom might actually have something to add regarding the cat program. Can you hang with us?
I will.
All right, excellent. We'll be right back.
Your pets don't like getting in cages and cars to go to the vet any more than you like sitting in a waiting room. Why not remove the stress for both of you? Have All Pets House Calls with me, Dr. Tom Picard, come take care of your pets from the comfort of their own couch. We do checkups and exams for illnesses, problems, shots, and much more. Monday through Saturday appointments throughout far and wide areas of Philadelphia and surrounding suburbs. Please call us at 215-843-1780, or please feel free to submit questions so I can answer them on the air for you. Contact us by email at allpetshousecalls@comcast.net or visit our website at allpetshousecallsvet.com.
We think our vet is very helpful. We think our vet is smart. Our vet takes such good care of us, but would rather stay home, would rather be home to catch mice.
And we're back on The Other Animals on WWDB. I forgot to mention, by the way, if you wanted to call in and talk to Jordan or Dr. Picard, feel free, 888-329-3306. That's 888-329-3306. Tommy, with us.
Yes, I am. Good morning.
All right. Good morning. So I'm curious. We've been mentioning here for a couple weeks now this concept of the cats and the spaying and neutering and the impact on the birds. And when you mentioned a couple weeks ago that that massive number that the in the billions that the impact of the cats on this issue with the birds, and I was incredulous and. And you've been borne out. Jordan has confirmed this. So I just wondered if what your thoughts are on what you've heard about that with the cats.
It definitely is a huge impact. I with this torn Achilles tendon, I mean, I've been pretty immobile this summer, so birding has actually helped keep me sane in my backyard.
Oh, well, there you go.
I was not somebody who ever really necessarily did it ever, but I have a really nice backyard, if I must say, and I've put, you know, the seed out and bird baths, and there's tons of natural vegetation and protection, and I have so many species back here, and it's like there's only so much TV I can watch.
Right, right.
Sitting here trying to heal my leg. And just hours and hours of just watching them is just really relaxing, and it's really entertaining and enjoyable.
That's
but yeah, I mean, the cats part of that is real. My ancient dog, who's 15 years old, killed a bird this summer. He could barely walk.
The dog? I didn't know they did
yeah,
that.
Yeah, I put him down outside, and suddenly he was a year old again for a second. And he charged out and grabbed the bird and killed it. I was like, oh my god!
Wow.
So imagine what a cat can do. My ancient dog can get one.
Yeah. Did you hear some of what Jordan was saying? Some of these programs that or these options for cat owners. Have you heard of any of these? Like the Catio sounds really interesting to me.
Yeah, no, I have seen some people, like for example, downtown Center City, Philadelphia. Some people who have outdoor connections from their apartment, but obviously they don't want their cat to run loose. I've seen all sorts of like kind of contraptions and screenings and like enclosed giant, almost looks like a giant playpen, and the cats can even turn this thing on their side and like run in it almost like a giant hamster wheel and wheel around their yard, but they can never escape it. You know, but they can see the outdoors, get wind in their face, and all that.
It seems like a nice medium. You know, it's interesting. The Jordan, the reason this came up a few weeks ago was we had a mild controversy on here on the other animals with spaying neutering, and there's actually a school of thought now that says well that maybe that's not not so much in the dog and cat's best interest, and so that it was an interesting conversation. But I'm curious from ABC's perspective. I would imagine that spay neuter is a component, right? You would actually be very much in favor from the standpoint of the birds to have your dogs and cats spayed neutered, or is that an element at all?
Well, we're definitely in favor of being again responsible with our pets. Mm-hmm. So if there are ways to reduce the cat population in a responsible way, then that would be something that we would favor. We do oppose just releasing of cats and dogs because that's not in the best interest of both that animal or wildlife because you're again exposing that cat or dog to threats outside, again possibly getting hit by a car or getting into poisons like antifreeze, and then they are also outside and potentially could have a negative interaction or impact on wildlife.
You know, it's interesting, and Tom or Jordan, you could chime in on this, that the study is focused on North America, right? I mean, that's where the 3 billion... And
the U.S. and Canada.
The U.S. and Canada, all right. I mean, the problem, the population issue, and I'm thinking feral dogs and cats. I mean, I've traveled, and for example, I was in Israel this summer, and the cats are just all over the place. The pet ownership is kind of odd. And there are different parts of the world where it's simply, I know, like in South America, it's dogs. Puerto Rico, I believe, where they're just everywhere, and there really is no population control. That must impact bird populations globally, doesn't it? I mean,
absolutely. It's not just a U.S. or U.S. and Canada problem. However, the paper only focused on those two countries. Mm-hmm. So I just want to, you know, I always go back to the science for the data and the facts.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, so go ahead, Tom. Yeah.
Oh, I was going to say, just as an aside, that you mentioned antifreeze. Most people don't realize that cats particularly are attracted to the flavor of antifreeze. They like it, and it shuts their kidneys down and kills them.
I had no idea. What's the solution? Or is there any? I mean, when we hit these other parts of the world that are beyond, you know, what we would normally think of our control for population, pet population, and you know, I'm thinking, you know, really the non-North America. Is there anything we can do, or we're sort of at the mercy of those societies and those cultures, right?
Well, I think it all starts with ourselves, right?
Yeah.
So first, it's both you as a private individual in your own home. What can you do for your own pet, your own home, your own backyard? And then move up from there. So as an American, you know, I say let's use our voices and tell our government officials that, you know, wildlife conservation is important, whether that's through different policies or legislation, different, you know, local ordinances. And then hopefully we can even go beyond that or have a domino effect.
Yeah, I mean, it all starts at home, right? I mean, that's where it has to begin. Hey, Tom, I'm just curious, during the conversation, it came up that I think Jordan mentioned that there is normally there are no, how'd you say, Jordan, there were no bird doctors, right? So that
well, I was trying to make a joke about birds being doctors.
No, I get you. I have actually had this, and this could be for either one. This is a really good story. So I think we maybe have all had a child or something that has seen an injured bird on the street. I know my daughter has done it more than once. They've seen, all of my daughters, in fact, have had this experience where they've found a bird, an injured bird, and they don't know what to do with it, right? So they'll maybe put it in a box and they'll start searching for a vet. But what they don't know is a lot of veterinarians don't do birds, right? So Tom, do you do birds? Is it a special
thing? Well, domestic birds. You have to actually have, I've taken care of course, wild birds, you know, but you're supposed to have a wild animal license to do it really officially.
Okay.
So one of the great advantages of, at least near me, sort of in Upper Roxboro, off of Ridge or Henry Avenue, is Schuylkill Valley Nature Center. And they are a great rehabilitation place for wildlife, whether it's if you can safely transport a wild animal that's been injured there, in a covered box so there's dark and they can't see out, and it reduces their stress. And you can get them to Schuylkill Valley Nature Center. They're a great rehab place.
Oh, all right. So I didn't know that. I didn't know that you had to be specially licensed for that.
Now you can, and there used to be a special service that was called a wildlife service just at the vet school at Penn, mm-hmm. where students ran it, and we took care of wildlife there, but you did have to have a special license, or the person who oversaw us had that, you know, coverage. But, imagine, regular vets, if you bring them in there and an animal's injured and they're going to help you take care of it, because some of them aren't going to make it to Schuylkill Valley Nature Center.
Yeah, that's right.
If there's anything you can do in the meantime, you're obligated to help, whether you have a license or not.
So we're getting close on it, but there was one question that I forgot to raise, and this, again, could go for either one. There was that last story that I had in the news about the parakeets. That's really... I found that we don't think of parakeets as invasive, and to me, parakeets are one of these types of birds that seem to cross the wild bird versus the domestic bird boundary. And so, I'm wondering, Jordan, if you had any thoughts on that story, and Tom, have you ever worked on parakeets, either one?
Yes, many. You know, people who have them as pets, of course. But yet, they just remind. There's a Westport, Connecticut, a town. Some friends who live in there, and years ago, somebody had, I believe the story is, lost a couple of their parrots. Got out, and the town is inundated with parrots.
All right. I do apologize. I'm not going to get to Jordan's response that we're out of time. So I definitely want to thank my guests today, our Jordan Rutter, Brian Quinlan, and of course Tom Picard. Thanks to again, if you want any more information on the American Bird Conservancy, that's abcbirds.org. Love to hear from you. So if you have ideas, comments, or interested in advertising on The Other Animals, go to theotheranimals.com. Don't forget to check out our partner podcasters at iroarpod.com. If I didn't mention, thanks to Jason Duffy. Next week, we're going to get that update that I promised last week about the Non-Human Rights Project and their victory with the elephant at the Bronx Zoo. And we're going to take a look at rabbits. We'll see you then. Thanks, everyone.